on today's episode of the Law of Tech podcast.
I mean, I think if you had to reduce all of this to one thing that the first time you see blows your mind is how fast these models can produce first drafts or correct answers. So in the context of like the bar exam papers, it was probably the MEE or MPT, or in the CPA exam, it was some of the written exercises where it has to like read a spreadsheet and understand the Internal Revenue Code and then apply some Treasury letter guidance and then calculate a number based on those classifications about like what is or isn't included in some definition of adjusted gross income, for example, right? That's like, holy cow, this is intelligence, right? It's like, this is for all intents and purposes, to be very kind of controversial, this is more intelligence than many people exhibit in knowledge work, at least, right? So within the context of knowledge work, what we call intelligence is, I'd argue, different than what we should call intelligence broadly. But yeah, that was the moment when it's like, putting the educator hat back on, you're like, okay, students, we need to change the curriculum, right? Students are going to have to do something else, or something's going to have to change, because if these things can do that, then we're going to have to do something different at scale.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Law of Tech podcast. I'm your host, Lasse Drukars, and I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Marco Mendola.
Hey, Adasa, how are you? Hello, everyone.
In this episode, we are continuing our conversation on AI and its impact on the law and legal profession. And for this, we are joined by Michael Obomarito, where we'll be talking everything legal education, legal certification, and AI. But before we delve deeper into the topic of this episode, a quick word from our sponsor, BettyBlocks. Are you looking for a way to create solutions that will make legal processes faster, easier, and more efficient? Do you want to offer the best client experience with great digital services? Well, look no further than our sponsor for this episode, BettyBlocks. Rapidly build custom legal tech applications such as legal intake portals, ESG assessments without a single line of code. Start building your own solutions today with BettyBlocks. So, Michael, I want to welcome you to the show. It's an absolute honor to have you join us and close this series that we are doing right now on AI and the law. So yeah, welcome to the show.
Guys, well, I'm honored. It's fun, to say the least, to talk about this topic. It's even more fun to get to talk about it with you two as part of the series that you've been doing. So let's see how much trouble we can stir up today.
What a great start. What a great start. Yes. You're going to be invited again and again and again, Mike.
Now, to kick off the episode, maybe let's give you the mic, actually, Michael, to introduce yourself. I'll hand the mic to you so you can talk a little bit more about yourself and what you're up to.
Yeah, and the irony here, in some sense, is that to discuss legal education and legal certification, well, you might think you'd want somebody who has been more properly qualified. In some sense, I have a abnormal or atypical background and career path, in part because I grew up in a house with two attorneys, and one of the things that they kind of instilled or taught me to do was to not become a lawyer or an attorney. So my mother had been one of the first women who made partner kind of generally or at a firm, and I'd seen the career path and was interested in, and one of the things that they said was like, this is a very difficult profession. It's a very difficult life, especially in some practice areas, right? And so don't do it. Now, as with all kids, there's an element of regression or kind of that inclination to do the opposite of what you're told to do. It had a measure of success, though, and so while I never actually became an attorney in the sense that I never went and got a JD or an LLM, I have practically always been in or a part of the things that you would normally associate with these kind of legal or legal-adjacent knowledge professions, right? So, like, I have almost always been doing something in financial services, accounting, or legal that most people would think I'm an attorney based on what I've done or the kinds of things I say or do or the areas I work in. And so it's been strange, I guess, to say the least. But here we are. And it does give me, I will say, a lot of leeway to speak openly on the topic because I don't carry a bar card. I teach at universities, but I'm not a tenured faculty professor that kind of depends on it for my living. So I have been in the belly of all of these beasts, if you will. I have seen many different kinds of sausage made, but I don't really have the same vested interest in some of those things that others might be more hesitant to say. So beware.
Well, in some of the research that you're doing about knowledge workers, which brings me more to like the topic of the episode that we want to discuss with you today. In some of the articles that you've written, you touch upon that topic, you explain in more depth what knowledge workers are, how AI impacts them. So maybe if we move a little bit more to that topic of knowledge work, can you maybe delve deeper into the topic? Tell us and our listeners especially more about what knowledge workers are, how they differ from traditional workers.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an academically loaded term, and there isn't even a single definition of knowledge worker in some sense that's universally accepted. All of that is to say knowledge workers are probably most simply defined as people who primarily think for a living, which isn't to say, of course, that, like, trust me, a farmer is a prototypical knowledge worker. They also have a large element of physical work, if you will, of not just moving things from one place to another, but knowing that they need to be able to move a thing to another place at a certain point in time, which is definitely knowledge work. But the knowledge workers kind of only do that latter half. They think about what you would need to have. They think about what you would need to do, about when you would need to do it. So in the context of, like, law and accounting, for example, which are the two areas that we've published on and recently in AI, lawyers and accountants tend to think about what you can or can't do. They tend to advise on what you should or shouldn't do. They tend to think about when you might need to do something right, or they need to essentially map out all of these different possibilities in their head. And one of the things that, like, the OECD and the UN and various other kind of large organizations have highlighted in a number of statistics that can be kind of viewed with a grain of salt, but all point in the same direction, is more and more of the world is engaged in knowledge work, right? Around the world, it's true. Within some countries in particular, the relative change is extreme. It's kind of a prototypical hallmark of the transition from, quote, emerging or, quote, third world countries to further up the classification, right, is more and more of a population engaged in knowledge work, which tends to look like sitting at a computer in a browser or in Word or in a spreadsheet or something like that, which turns out AI has obviously gotten to be fairly good at.
There's one thing I think, Michael, that's intriguing, at least for me. Have you ever ask as an open question to lawyers or accountants in your lessons or in your workshops, have you ever tried to, like, to push forward just the concept of knowledge worker, like, or saying, hey guys, you are knowledge workers? And maybe usually I'm expecting the response, oh no, I'm a lawyer and I'm not an accountant, I'm not like them, and vice versa, because we often discuss labels in the profession, in the law of tech. And that's why, as you may know, lawyers are also quite obsessed with definitions, right? So I was wondering if you can share a couple of funny things that happened to you, maybe from your working experience regarding sharing the concept of knowledge worker, if any. Yeah.
I mean, it's the sociology of labels is obviously at the forefront of this conversation. Like, to the extent that an individual or an organization wants to kind of do the things that organizations typically want to do to maintain some kind of power hierarchy or to exclude others, to have economic or political control of things, well, labels are pretty effective at that, right? And there isn't a much better example of a label that accomplishes that than the bar card in the U.S. in particular. where we have the least mm-hmm. alternative legal service delivery options. So, I mean, it has gotten to be better, I would say, over the last two decades or so that I've experienced it. We clearly have more open conversations about discussing the labels of other people inside of legal organizations. Like the phrase non-lawyer has gotten to be somewhat less openly allowed to be used, you might say. But I mean, the thing is, there's definitions are a good thing. We all need to be clear, right? Like, just take contracts as an example. A contract section with no capitalized defined terms, well, puts a lot of onus on the parties to eventually resolve that in court. So having defined terms helps avoid downstream issues, you might just say. And a label about a person is a kind of defined term that helps set expectations or maybe obligations in some sense around the interaction or what you'd expect from the person. So it all has a purpose or role, but at the end of the day, people should be more focused on doing their job well than asserting a label to prevent others from doing a thing. It's my take on it. So I think if everybody thought of themselves as a knowledge worker and focused on doing a good job of performing knowledge work tasks, regardless of what they were, that would be the right way of thinking about it. And yeah, it's always interesting to hear people, in particular, dualies, as we often call them at school, right? Like the JD MBAs or the JD CPAs, and how their identity aligns across these multipolar labels where you're like, am I a JD? Am I a CPA? Am I a JD? Am I an MBA? So it has been getting better over the years. I won't name names or probably call out anybody in particular on any stories like this. But at the end of the day, it's like I remember the flashcards my wife made when she was studying for the reg exam, which is one of the four parts of the CPA exam. And the reg exam, as far as I could tell, looked like what the bar exam should be like. It's a bunch of very practical questions about the laws and rules that normal organizations face on a regular basis. It's not like trying to carve up some 19th century case about seizing 99 barrels of coffee or whatever, just because once in every thousand matters, there may be a tangential issue related to this, or like Replevin or something like that, right? It's like, no, this is like, these are the three most common types of entities. There's a C corp, an S corp, and an LLC or whatever. And here are the things that each has to do. And here are the sections of the US code, the IRC, the CFR, state regulations that are relevant to doing the things that a normal C corp has to do. So I think anybody, I will kind of writ large here make a claim, which is anybody who's been a part of a CPA process of like getting a CPA in particular will appreciate that all of knowledge work is really the same thing, because the CPA exam is so cross-cutting, and the AI CPA is actually making it even more cross-cutting. They're including a bunch of technology competency, including information security, into the CPA exam. So, yeah, I will say the AI CPA gets it. They've honestly always gotten it in a deeper sense, from an educational perspective, from a curriculum perspective. And it would be great, I'm not holding my hopes, but it would be great if the ABA and the NCBE would look to the AI CPA for more guidance on education and certification, because they're also a guild. They also have some elements of protectionism, but they seem to have done a better job about at least keeping up with the times and preparing people. So it's not impossible.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I guess that's three aspects really play a role here, right? Quality, pride, and differentiation.
Yeah.
How realistic is it that it will actually change?
This is the hardest thing. I can predict a lot of things, but When is always the most difficult thing, right? Will it be economic pressure? Will it be social pressure? Will it be like political policy change independent? I don't know. Normally it takes a confluence of things, and typically something has to be fundamentally broken before something this entrenched changes. I hesitate to speculate about what that could be, right? I mean, even in 2000, say late 7 through 9, when we hit the first wave of that last recession or depression, whatever you want to call it, like, there were changes in the legal market. There were some structural changes in terms of, like, alternative legal service providers or the adoption of legal technology in corporates. But fast forward 10, 15 years again, and we're right back to high billable rates and large pyramids at law firms, right? So it didn't really change anything in the bar. I mean, the NCBE and the state bars in the U.S. at least have started to introduce a new bar exam, but it's not really different in ways that I think it could or should be different, and it's not really clear how it's going to serve the purpose, which, maybe if I speak in reductionism, is simply to gatekeep and limit the flow of supply into the market. So if they make the exam too easy, then what are you really doing, and how does that work with the guild economics? And if you make the exam too hard, well, what are you really doing? You could make it more practical, but that doesn't seem to be the culture of legal education, practical learning, right?
No.
So I don't know what we're left with. Radically reimagining how we educate students so that they're prepared to actually perform legal work for law firms or corporate, or, I mean, let's not even talk about serving individuals, right? That's impossible when we have...
Oh, no, we don't provide legal as a service here. No,
to come all the way back to things you're not really supposed to talk about, but I'm not a tenure-track professor, the financing model of universities in legal, like law schools, is, especially in the U.S., right, dependent on this kind of debt-laden student model. Unless and until some of the economics around that change, and depending on how some of these universities and the law schools that aren't exactly on a sustainable financial footing, like how some of that plays out again, especially if there's another downturn that does not result in students going back to school, that's what I would speculate would change this most, is more law schools getting into trouble in the middle of a recession when firms are not going to take new associates. Because then the pyramid, the kind of cravath model of the law firm pyramid, kind of necessarily narrows at the base, because they just bring in fewer associates anyway at the beginning. So, but long story short, I don't know. I hate to guess when.
Maybe better that you didn't have an answer. At least a fixed answer. You didn't mention technological developments or further technological developments. So I know we're speaking a lot about AI, and that's also obviously the whole topic of this sub-series. Particularly, we wanted to touch on with you on generative AI, on large language models. Tell us more about that, because you haven't mentioned it yet. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know what role that plays in this whole discussion that we just had about transformation of certification also. You also mentioned that it's impacting knowledge work in the legal profession, also in other professions, obviously. But let's focus on legal for now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the easiest thing to say is the thing that we said in the paper that changed the course of the year for us, at least, right? It's like, if the thing that we use to gatekeep and to assess the credibility or qualification of a person to perform a certain type of work is this exam, and this jumble of numbers that multiply by each other and spit out words is able to pass that exam, then what do we do, or what should we do, that this thing is or isn't capable of, right? So, like, GPT-4 passes the bar exam in the U.S. in basically every single state at a grade that most students would be happy to get on their first try. What does that mean about what we're going to do as attorneys or legal professionals in the future? Because it sure shouldn't be the things that we at least thought were shown by this exam to be gatekeeping for entry into the profession. And the questions, I mean, your question comes back to, like, how will it change the industry? I think the question before that is, what are we doing in the industry right now? Right? How do you carve up legal work? Which parts of legal work, which types of legal tasks are actually amenable to automation or should be automated or can be safely automated. That's where like the rubber hits the road, if you will, and you have to go do all of the research. You need to do all of the work, really, which is what a lot of legal tech companies are doing, like as you guys know. Mm-hmm. So in the U.S., at least, there has been a lot of work, in particular transactional work or things like discovery and investigation work, that for the last 10 or 15 years has already been on a trajectory of increasing automation, right? You just think of how we went from TAR, technology-assisted review, to all these e-discovery companies, to e-discovery companies like Relativity getting involved in things like contracts to support M&A. And I think that's a pretty easy arc to just continue drawing, right? Like put the pen down right where it ends today and keep the trajectory up and to the right in terms of the percentage of document review, discovery, transactional support that's done by machines.
I just want to know more because I've read, we have read your article a few times, and what came out from my reading, the first question I had in mind was, I want to ask Michael, what's the data he was most impressed about? As a researcher. So, because I'm sure you have, you know, you have done your tests, read your literature, you had potentially brainstorming sessions with your cohorters, but you, Michael, you finished the research and you say, I wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
Can you tell me one thing that particularly struck your attention?
I think if you had to reduce all of this to one thing that the first time you see blows your mind is how fast these models can produce first drafts or correct answers, right? As you say, this is especially like I wrote my first neural network in Fortran or C or something 20 some years ago. I remember how slow it was on like when a 486 was new, right? Like in the days when everybody was first watching those Pentium ads, you thought, wow, I can get my hands on one of those. But a neural network back then, a very small neural network, a little perceptron, whatever, was still very slow. And the idea that barely a quarter century later, all of a sudden, the same fundamental idea is capable of producing 500 to 1,000 words in a couple seconds or under a minute of very high quality text that combines an analysis of the facts presented inside of the input with a broad amount of knowledge about the world outside. That was like, well, holy cow. So in the context of like the bar exam papers, it was probably the MEE or MPT. Or in the CPA exam, it was some of the written exercises where it has to like read a spreadsheet and understand the Internal Revenue Code and then apply some Treasury letter guidance and then calculate a number based on those classifications about like what is or isn't included in some definition of adjusted gross income, for example, right? That's like, holy cow, this is intelligence, right? It's like, this is, for all intents and purposes, to be very kind of controversial, this is more intelligence than many people exhibit in knowledge work, at least, right? So within the context of knowledge work, what we call intelligence is, I'd argue, different than what we should call intelligence broadly. But yeah, that was the moment when I was like, putting the educator hat back on, you're like, okay, students, we need to change the curriculum, right? Students are going to have to do something else or something's going to have to change, because if these things can do that, then we're going to have to do something different at scale.
We actually have a question from our previous guest on the show, because we were talking about how the bar exam really is not up to date with what it should be, and legal education isn't either. A question that our previous guest has asked is whether the jobs of lawyers, legal professionals, will be replaced in the future. And I think the question there mainly also lies in considering whether or not we change certification mechanisms as they are right now, legal education as it is right now. But I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
I'll give a partial answer and then maybe a fuller answer in sequence. I would look at it from the perspective of an individual attorney, more like the industrialization of, say, agrarian work. Right? Once upon a time, if you were a farmer, you did things by hand at a scale that was fairly small. And then maybe you had a horse or some other livestock, and you had a slightly larger scale, and then you started to have farm implements and tools. Maybe some people went towards, and some types of crops, there still are kind of labor leverage ratios, right, where you do end up with lots of people on some tasks. But increasingly, over the last 100 years, tractors, for example, or in large part tractors, right, have changed the way that agrarian work is performed. And one farmer is now able to manage with industrial kind of techniques, and there's other kind of concerns or issues with that, right? But if you just say, what are you able to do? One person with a large tractor and the right implements can now perform substantially more crop growing than a farmer could 100 years ago. So if there's, and to continue this analogy, if the demand for food in the world outstrips the supply of food in the world, that's a good thing, because there wasn't enough food in the world to feed the people who wanted food, so now there's more food. Obviously, there's the distribution issue, which is true of both food and legal services, right? But I would say that's the first point I would try to make is you can do more now. And there was always an outsized amount of demand for legal services relative to supply. Now, the question is, of course, is that demand in the corporate markets or the enterprise markets where people are used to billing high dollar rates, or is that aggregate demand actually down below, in quotes, like individuals or the access to justice problem? And then how would business models need to change and expectations need to change for people to actually take advantage of that aggregate demand? So that's kind of a related issue. And I think the answer to whether or not people can figure out how to tap into that unmet demand and actually serve it in ways that are economically viable is the kind of gating condition for whether or not this creates new jobs in legal services or whether this doesn't. So,
and connected to that, Mike, I think this is a perfect link for the second part of the question from our mystery guest that would be revealed very soon. His second question was, I think, as obvious as funny, but I want to know your thoughts, Michael. Why is the world so obsessed with AI in legal? It seems, at least, that there's a particular attention. Okay, AI, or wider, as a wider definition, we can then discuss it as large language models or generative AI. We don't want to go into the rabbit hole of definitions because we are not technicians and we don't aim for that. But don't you think you are basically an interdisciplinary researcher, advisor? So you said before, I'm a lawyer, but not so much. I love to do many things, etc. What do you think? Do you agree with our mystery guest question about why the world is so obsessed with AI in legal, or why legal think they have a kind of like a legitimacy to say, oh, AI is such a big service we need to discuss for the sake of our profession and so on and so forth? What do you think?
It is a landmark profession, right? In some sense, it is the... if you think that law is kind of the foundation of institutions and institutions are what make modern societies and civilization, then the legal worker is, and if you trace some of the etymology of the words in different languages, right, they are the priests of this, quote, religion to civilization or institutions in society. And so this is in some sense replacing the, and again, I use fairly loaded terminology here, the priests or gods of our institutions or societies are now machines or can be made to be machines, which is, if you track like some of the various Jungian concepts that seem to appear in science fiction or fantasy or mythology through different human societies, like that is seems to be a fairly prototypical story, right? Is a priest or god being replaced with something else, and this is like a very 21st century version of that. So these are the people who speak to and create our institutions, and now all of a sudden they are machines or robots. They are not human. Previously, they were at least other humans, elevated humans, humans who learned a special language, who could who could chant these incantations, these special words, right? Like, that's what it is. I mean,
that's what it is. It's a fantastic metaphor. I love it. And I think there's room to write some sci-fi comics from now on. So stay tuned.
We've looked a lot at AI in the past month / 2 months, I would say. There obviously are also speculations on advancements in technologies. Looking at potential other topics to discuss, things that are relevant into the legal industry, legal certification, legal education. What's a topic that you, because we obviously we don't have another guest on this episode or this series to ask the question, but I'm curious to know from you what you think would be a highly relevant topic to talk about that maybe would offer some new perspectives on, well, the legal profession, legal education and certification.
Yeah, let me give you... future. I'll put my interdisciplinary hat on, right, as like it. If you think of this as a complex system involving humans, then the two things that I almost always look at the world through are sociology and economics, which are maybe the same discipline, maybe not, depending on who you ask in some sense. But if you say, what are the social or even anthropological, like historical elements of how legal services came to be the way it is today, I think that would be an interesting thing to think about and look at. For example, so much of everything that we talked about today, everyone's talking about right now, is based on the cravath model of a law firm, which is largely about a progressive leverage of labor from the top tier, the equity partners, down to non-equity and associate and other staff, right? That's not the only way to organize a legal services organization, right? And it wasn't even the way it was organized up until the early 20th century. And there's a whole history of how that came to be and then how other firms adopted that. And there's this economics of firms, which is maybe a sensitive topic to some degree, but so much of what happens or doesn't happen comes back to the politics and economics of these bellwether firms, especially the Verein or the global affiliate structures. So, and you guys are in London there right now. I think everybody's watching Kirkland and Allen and Overy and Shearman do their thing, and Paul Weiss now too. So it's like, if you don't acknowledge that the economics and sociology and politics that drive that are real, we don't talk about it, then it's hard to figure out what's going on, let alone what you might want to think about if you wanted to change something. So it's a dangerous topic in some elements, right? Because you're going to get a profit per partner and business models and how that profit per partner comes to be. But that's the only way you're going to change this stuff, right? Because again, it's like underneath all these conversations is the billable hour under a cost plus model where somebody is collecting the margin that you're not getting paid. Yeah. And unless you change the billable hour model, there's just going to be an intrinsic limit on the scale. But switching to fixed fee or to other pricing models means you're going to have to be a totally different kind of organization that understands how to price things and collects data that supports pricing, which is a different culture. And then you need a different culture to attract people who know how to do that stuff. Or you have to teach it to the attorneys in law school. But they went to law school because they didn't like numbers. So how are you going to teach them how to price if they don't like numbers? Well, maybe AI GPT-6 will change that. I don't know. So it's all interconnected.
It's going to be interesting to find guests for a series on this show, on this topic.
To make it real and to understand in practice how you, Michael, are trying, at least in the AI data gathering side, to deliver your contribution. How would you take your responsibility to bring something new and forward? I've done some proper, obviously, research on your projects and what you're doing so far. And I'm aware of the Kelvin Legal Data OS project. And I would like to ask you directly if you can share some insights together with, you know, with us and our listeners. It sounds intriguing and interesting, but hey, it's always best to hear from, from the author.
I mean, you think about AI as like the mainframes. They're very difficult to use. Software had to be written in a very complex way. It was incredibly difficult to scale that. And therefore, most people didn't get a chance to use a computer or benefit from a computer. The operating systems that were developed, and then the miniaturization of computers that happened, and the open sourcing of all of that, created essentially the phones that we have on our desk today, among many other things along the way. And so the point of the legal data operating system for us is kind of like this arc from mainframes to personal computers to smartphones. We have to share this componentry across the industry, because if everyone is constantly rebuilding this stuff, then we're never going to get anywhere. And part of this is, just like many operating systems today, like on your phone, data and these core models. So we built Kelvin in part to collect all of the data from legal and regulatory data sources to be able to even train our own large language model from scratch on data that, by the way, would be compliant with the EU AI Act. So this is part of what we've been working on, and why we've been a little quiet about it is because it's not the kind of thing you can just do overnight and flip a switch and come out of stealth with. But we hope to have a large language model trained on over 300 billion tokens of legal and regulatory information with clean copyright and IP suitable for use in the EU, with all of the software around it that you would need to use the thing safely and trustworthily. So
thank you also for sharing that. We're very curious to know what the response is going to be. I don't think we've had an episode like this at all so far. I want to thank you, Michael, for sharing all of your insights with us. It was super interesting, and it's given us a lot of food for thought and potentially a whole new sub-series of the Law of Tech podcast for the future. So thank you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much, Michael, for being with us.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Law of Tech podcast. If you want to make sure you keep up to date with the show and never miss out on an episode, be sure to subscribe on your podcast platform of choice and follow the Law of Tech on social media. If you enjoyed the show, please give it a rating or review, as it helps others discover the show. And don't forget to share it with your network. For now, have a great day, and I'll see you in the next episode of the Law of Tech podcast. We'll be right back.